Welcome to Amplify, a podcast about the future of Europe, produced by the DCU Brexit Institute. We cover the latest developments in European integration, including the Conference on the Future of Europe and the Next Generation EU Post-Pandemic Recovery Plan. I'm your host, Ian Cooper. Today's episode is a recording of an event titled Economic Governance in the EU After the Conference on the Future of Europe. It is a panel discussion chaired by Federico Fabbrini, featuring contributions by Neil Richmond, Calypso Nicolaides, Paul Dermin, and Sergio Battelli. The event took place on June 16th at the DCU Brexit Institute as part of the Jean Monnet Center of Excellence Rebuild.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Dublin City University. My name is Federico Fabbrini. I am a professor of EU law, the founding director of the Brexit Institute and the PI of the Jean Monnet Center of Excellence Rebuild. And it is my great pleasure to welcome you all to this afternoon event entitled Economic Governance in the European Union After the Conference on the Future of Europe. This is the second event organized within the framework of the Jean Monnet Center of Excellence Rebuild, which is a three-year project funded under the EU Erasmus Plus program. Rebuild is the first ever Jean Monnet Center of Excellence hosted at Dublin City University. It is led by the Brexit Institute and involves scholars in law, politics, and political economy from across the School of Law and Government of our university. The purpose of the Rebuild project is to explore the Next Generation EU Recovery Fund, which, as you know, is a massive 800 billion euros budget that the European Union put together in 2020 to respond to the socioeconomic consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic. The purpose of Rebuild is to examine the governance, the founding values, and the founding mechanism of Next Generation EU, but also to reflect on its impact on European integration. From this point of view, therefore, I am delighted that we are able to host this panel discussion this afternoon, which is combining the analysis of Next Generation EU with the results of the Conference on the Future of Europe, which, as you know, concluded just a little over a month ago and was a year-long innovative deliberative process involving European citizens to reflect on the future of Europe. The aim of our panel this afternoon is precisely to discuss how the outcome of the conference, as summarized in its final report, will impact the discussion about the future of the architecture of economic governance in Europe, including potentially transformation of NGEU into a permanent instrument. And to discuss those topics, we have put together a stellar cast of speakers, including both academics and policymakers. So let me introduce to you today our speakers, starting with Neil Richmond, who is a member of the Dáil, the Irish Parliament, sitting in the Joint Committee of EU Affairs. And Neil was also the Irish representative in the plenary of the Conference on the Future of Europe. So good afternoon, Neil. We also have this afternoon Sergio Battelli, who is a member of the Italian Camera dei Deputati, the lower house of the Italian Parliament, where he chairs the EU Affairs Committee. Moreover, I am delighted to welcome Calypso Nicolaidis, who is professor at the School of Transnational Governance of the European University Institute on leave from the University of Oxford. And last but not least, my friend Paul Dermin, who is a graduate from the University of Maastricht and currently serving as a referendaire at the Court of Justice of the European Union in Luxembourg. Some of the speakers this afternoon are new. Some are old friends of the Brexit Institute. In particular, let me acknowledge that Calypso was actually present at the moment of creation as she spoke in March 2017 at the event that led to the foundation of the Brexit Institute. And Neil has also been a friend of ours for many years. I recall a nice event we hosted in Paris 3 years ago before the pandemic at the Irish embassy there. So it's a pleasure to see old friends and to welcome new friends. And just to clarify the rule of the games. I'll ask each speaker to take the floor for maximum 5-7 minutes. So we leave room for debate and discussion afterwards. There will be the possibility for the public to intervene in the Q&A session. Let me just emphasize that the event is being recorded. Unfortunately, Sergio Battelli had a last minute institutional commitment, so he cannot be with us live or synchronously this afternoon, but he did send a recorded message, which we will project later on. But to get going, let me actually give immediately the floor to Neil, as he has been, as I said, a member of the plenary on the Conference on the Future of Europe. So I think has a firsthand account of what happened. So Neil, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Federico, and good afternoon, ladies, or indeed good evening, ladies and gentlemen, depending where in Europe you're or beyond you're tuning in from. It is absolutely wonderful to join you today. And when you reminded me of that wonderful event in Paris, Federico, I think it was about 42 degrees centigrade that day. Well, it certainly feels like that in Dublin today, having just run from another conference in Charlemagne. So excuse me if I'm a little bit out of puff and red of face. I'm going to make a few points just to kick off, and we can explore them a lot more in the discussion. They're not going to be necessarily very definite points, and they're certainly not going to be revolutionary recommendations, but it'll be based on my experiences both as a delegate to the plenary of the Conference on the Future of Europe and generally working in and around the European institutions pretty much my entire adult life since leaving university, like probably quite a few people on this call. I suppose first to the conference, and for me, the conference really took two parts, before Russia's latest invasion of Ukraine and second. And I fundamentally believe a lot of the recommendations that were made in advance of that period became crystallized afterwards. The sheer operation of the conference, dealing with coming out of the pandemic, dealing with a very tight time frame, dealing with the logistics of getting so many people to Strasbourg so regularly, meant that it was a little bit disorganized, to be quite frank. And one of my great early disappointments is that we tend to start on a Thursday evening of a plenary week in the European Parliament. And it felt like the MEPs that were delegates really just wanted to take the debates they'd just had all week in Strasbourg and roll them over into the conference, ignoring the recommendations of the citizens and indeed the input of other stakeholders, be they national member state parliamentarians like myself, ministers through the European Council, or various other representative groups, be they trade unions, the business groups, as they came in. And that definitely took a focus when it came to economic governance and when it took to the next generation EU and the whole demand for more Europe when it came to spending, but also a greater focus on what the needs of Europeans are. And certainly, and it goes to all areas, but when it came, and not just economic affairs, there was two or three fairly consistent themes. One, the desire of the citizens for a more environmentally friendly approach. The whole aspect of climate was a real concern throughout. But secondly, there was often recommendations made that were about things that the EU was already doing. So it kind of goes to the forefront of the communications deficit that the European Union has. And I'm a fervent pro-European. I'm a politician. I don't need to be balanced in this regard. But one of my staunch criticisms of the European project is that it's really good at paying people to give out about it, but it's not necessarily very good at telling people all the really amazing things that the European project has been doing over the last number of decades. You name a member state, they have benefited from European membership, including the one that sadly left. But I suppose a lot of the recommendations that were made and how they feed in, there was a genuine feeling that what the European Union was forced to do by the pandemic provides a template of where it should move going forward, how it should get more involved, be it in the area of health competence, be it in the area of generating own resources. And I think this is something that a lot of politicians, particularly ministers at a European Council level, had maybe pushed back against for a long time. But I think that's going to see the real depth of discussion when a convention is formed and when we actually start to look at the recommendations. Because let's be frank, the recommendations as they were all just accepted. There wasn't any real votes. I was in the working group on economic social justice and jobs. And there was definite clashes, like there was two quite clear camps. And sadly, the citizens sort of got stuck in the middle between the broadly centre-left groupings. And that was bringing together politicians with trade unions and other civic society groups and the broadly centre-right groups, politicians like myself and indeed business representative groups. And they kind of came down the two sort of typical box that we'd see in European politics with the sort of smaller groupings kind of feeding in. But ultimately, there wasn't massive division. The only thing where I remember a real big row, certainly in my working group, was at the very last point, and it was very much a stage row over qualitative majority voting. And that was stirred up simply by Eurosceptic parliamentarians from fairly predictable Central and Eastern European member states. So I think there were some key areas. Definitely, when we look at the economy and jobs, there was a huge focus on SMEs. That's understandable. That's something that is often spoken to, but it's now the practicality of how do you not just talk about SMEs, but actually show exactly how they are benefiting from the recommendations, from the economic governance, from the institutional direction. And I suppose there was certainly one that I had a great row about was in relation to tax harmonisation across the European Union. And I would be a pretty lousy Irish politician if I didn't have that row. And I was with a delightful Italian trade unionist. There was nothing lost in translation. Let's put it about that plenary discussion. And many of you have seen that go back and forth over the last couple of years. I'm about to pause here, Federico, because there's no point me giving a weighty definite opinion and telling people what we're going to discuss, because I think the whole purpose, not just of this particular Zoom, but the work, the wonderful work you're doing in this regard in the Brexit Institute, is to formulate discussions. And one thing I'd like to take away, and it's the exact same, I was just at another conference by a couple of foundations this afternoon in Dublin, and we were talking about trade policy and we were talking about security, two very different but very similar areas that are very popular at the moment. And my challenge to I suppose that the academics and the political thought leaders there is, I'm a practicing politician. I have to now take the opinions and the issues that we're going to discuss over the next 90 minutes or 60 minutes, whatever it is, and bring it back to the electorate and say, this is the direction the European Union needs to go in, this direction Ireland needs to go in, and this is why it's worthy for us to get behind it. Because we can often lose ourselves in these discussions in acronyms and very internal causative debates. But sadly, the real challenge is then to be able to put that out to the general populace, be it undergraduate students that you lecture, Federico, or the people that I very much hope re-elect me in 3 years' time. With that regard, I'll hand over to the panel and look forward to coming back in due course. Come on.
Thanks very much, Neil. And I'll move straight to Calypso speaking to us from the European University Institute. And as both a European citizen and a UK citizen, I shall notice, so perhaps enriching our perspective on all those discussions. Calypso, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Federico, and a pleasure to be joining friends at the Brexit Institute, and indeed echoing Neil on all the great work you're doing here. I would like to very much echo Neil in my enthusiasm for what's happened in the conference on the future of Europe, and Neil will know very well how some of us were a bit skeptical at the beginning. But here in Florence, we had one of the citizens panel, in fact, the citizen panel on democracy, and very much shadowed and analyzed what was going on with our students, colleagues, European institutions. And I think that it's fair to say that in our topic today, the governance, economic governance of the EU, there were two intersecting agendas from the citizens' viewpoint. One is spend more and better at the European level in a more coordinated way to tackle the great challenges of our time. But second, and that came from one panel, economic panel, and then in our democracy panel, and I was there for the conversations. A lot of discussions was on, yes, where do we invest, but also the oversight and accountability of investment in the EU. And this was really striking in that regard. And I apologize, there's a bit of background noise, circumstances of life. And so one of the lessons for me that has emerged is that we need to feed the results of the conference on the future of Europe with the lessons we might take from the first steps of Next Generation EU. So here are two kind of processes that happened in the EU. Where do they come together? And where they come together, well, they come together because we may want to look at next generation EU and ask ourselves, you know, how significant, what kind of revolution has it been for the EU? And I wrote this little piece, I'll put a connection in the chat. In fact, in Italy, a critical exchange on next generation EU, it's called Once in a Lifetime, an imminent critique of next gen. And here, the point is to say, well, yeah, it's been, of course, significant in the amount of money spent, the material injection of funds, where the importance of the goals of the double transition, and of course, also the institutional side, the first European mutualization of debt. And indeed, Federico's question is critical. Will this be permanent? I believe it will be permanent. But Federico, as we always do, we have to ask, under what conditions will it be sustainably permanent? And I think that for that, this is where we need to transform l'essai, as we would say in France, because the third way in which it's been significant is to ask what it's done to the European polity and to its democratic character. And there, the question is whether the two shifts that we see with NextGen Fund will actually actualize, will really become real. The first is that what I call the deference with purpose, that contrary to what's happened with the Euro Monetary Union, we see that the EU has kind of given, told member states, hey, you guys, you decide your priorities, debate with your parliaments, government, etc. We control how your money is used, but there is much more deference than interference. If we think of the IR game as always deference and interference balance. And the second shift, as important, is the fact that there's been much more emphasis on extent accountability. And accountability all the way down. So there's accountability to EU institutions, yes, and to domestic control bodies, but also more political accountability. And so what we really see with Next Generation EU is an attempt to invent a genuine public accountability system, more advanced, and hopefully something that can be inspiring in the rest of the world, given the big geopolitical debates that we're having. And this stems from like three connected requirements. You know, the first requirement is no spending without taxation. Now that the EU is issuing debt, borrowing, well, at some point it will need to tax for that. And you can say, well, you know, we'll tax the GAFAs. But there's taxing GAFA is not neutral. It depends where the money goes. So there will be a very big debate in the next few years as to who decides on these taxes and where do they go? How does the EU reimburse itself? And of course, there'll be the emissions trading system, but these could fund other things. So the question of the taxation and accountability will be very important. Spending leads to taxation. Taxation, of course, leads to representation. That's the second requirement. No taxation without representation. And there, of course, we've seen that with Next Generation EU, we have had these modes of scrutiny. There has been a policy mode where the country programs are assessed and audited on the basis of these performance criteria for everyone to see, but these are big aggregated tables. And then there's a second different kind of ethical mode, which is more about ex post control for fraud, conflict of interest, nepotism, and all that. There's an Arachne database. And I'm not gonna get into detail because my, you know, time is running out, but we could get into how this works concretely. But the problem with that is that it does go further than before. But we're not quite sure what happens when these national plans that are scrutinized by the Commission are then implemented at the level of specific project. Yes, there is a national audit system, control and audit system, CAS, But what happens next? And this leads me to my third and final, you know, point. After no spending without taxation, after no taxation without representation, Federico, we have no representation without participation these days, because that's what the Conference on the Future of Europe is all about, is to invent a new mode of coexistence between representative democracy and participatory democracy. Now, if you want to have participatory democracy in an ecosystem in the EU, what you really need is to empower citizens to do the deed. And they're busy, they're doing all sorts of other things. So you need to empower them. And indeed, that means that the projects of NextGen EU, if you ask me, should be all over the web. Everything needs to be under radical transparency if we're going to enhance not just the legitimacy of the funds, but the efficacy of the fund. There is a project now, pan-European project of journalists called the Recovery Files Fund, initiated by the Dutch company Follow the Money. And with journalists from 20 member states, there was one in Spain that called Coalición Pro Acceso of the Open Generation EU platform. And they're kind of making this point. But my big hope is that every member state will follow through and put the information on the web. This is what I call the democratic panopticon. Let the citizens watch, analyze, and critique how the funds are being used. And this is, I think, where we're going to bring together the spirit of the Conference on the Future of Europe and the spirit of Next Generation EU to kind of reinvent a new agenda for our EU for the future. And that will make it sustainable, Federico.
Thank you so much, Calypso, for your inspired and inspiring presentation. And let me hand now straight the floor to Paul, who I shall mention has also a forthcoming book with Cambridge University Press, which is the published version of his PhD dissertation entitled The New Economic Governance of the Eurozone, out, I think, this summer. Paul, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Federico. And as my other fellow panelists, let me once again thank you and the Brexit Institute for the very kind invitation. Now, as Calypso has just mentioned, there are many reasons why NGEU is a rather revolutionary initiative. I think we'll all agree that it was a big moment in the history of European integration, one of these moments where the impossible suddenly becomes possible, where some taboos can be broken, where the line shifts, and where structural change can potentially happen. Now, what I also find interesting is the continuity that NGEU embodies. And from this perspective, I see at least two main continuities that NGEU embodies, two main problems that the plan, in a way, replicates and that would need to be addressed in the future. The first continuity that I'd like to highlight is a primarily legal one, but it goes actually much, much deeper than the law itself. And that's the fact that just as the new economic governance saw the light of the day after the Eurozone crisis, well, Next Generation EU was established within the existing treaty framework, so without any kind of change to EU primary law. So this little revolution occurred, I would not say beyond the law, but to a very large extent, despite the law. So institutional lawyers, of course, did their job, they did what they had to do. They used the available legal basis to turn this political deal into a reality. But they had to display an unprecedented level of innovation. And in a way, they twisted the legal basis to go beyond what they had primarily been established for. So there's two main cases of that. There's, first of all, the use of the emergency clause of the treaties, Article 122, to bring about Next Generation EU, using this legal base to adopt such an ambitious plan. And then there's also the mobilization of cohesion policy to basically bring about a new autonomous economic and industrial policy. So there are some risks associated with this continuous trend of working à droit primaire constant, so within existing primary law. The first risk is, of course, that the legal construction of the plan remains rather fragile. It lacks firm constitutional foundations, and it also exposes itself to legal challenges. There's also a risk of misunderstanding, and that's very clear now. The north of Europe NGO is very much seen as a one-off instrument that is not to be replicated. But elsewhere in Europe, it's seen as the first step towards the fiscal union, the first embodiment of a much more structural evolution. And of course, misunderstanding can lead to political backlash. And we see it currently. We see attempts from the EU institutions to replicate that template in other circumstances, such as the Ukraine funds, such as REPowerEU, and this sparks strong political oppositions. Now, one continuity is that one. The other continuity is an institutional kind of continuity. And here, my appreciation is that the governance of a Next Generation EU is, to a very large extent, in line with the economic governance model we inherited from the euro crisis. At least at EU level, that executive dominance, which has characterized economic governance since the outset, is still very much there. And it, in my view, can also be observed at the national level. Also within the Commission itself, there's an increased centralization that is at play. And this too carries certain risks. There's the risk of opacity, a risk of concealed politicization, which could lead to popular frustration and potentially to inefficient disbursement of the funds. And I think the recent approval of the Polish plan is a good example of that. We saw how opaque and how untransparent the governance of Next Generation EU can be. The last form of continuity that I'd like to highlight very much relates to the most recent macroeconomic development we've seen. It's as if we were about to enter a remake of the political and economic circumstances that we've experienced 10 years ago. So again, it might be in a way the past coming back to haunt us, and the good vibes of Next Generation EU might soon become a bit of a souvenir. So in the light of these three continuities, well, I believe those are also among the main challenges that the future of economic governance needs to tackle. And in the light of the recommendations of the Conference on the Future of Europe, efforts should certainly be deployed to address these issues. The first issue is if you talk about making Next Generation EU permanent, I believe there's no other way around it than to amend the treaties and foreseen sound, solid legal basis for permanent fiscal transfers and a permanent central fiscal capacity, which can play a stabilization role. I really believe that this way of doing things incrementally has reached an end stop. There now needs to be a constitutional acknowledgement of the magnitude of the changes at play. The other challenge for the future is certainly reorienting the European semester and economic governance as a whole. Certainly, the current context has made a reform of the Stability and Growth Pact and of the EU's fiscal policy rules inevitable. Reading the proposals of the conference, there's also a very strong emphasis on the social orientation of economic governance and on the implementation of the pillar of social rights. There too, change would very much be warranted. And the legal basis there, when it comes to social and employment policy, the legal basis are there. It's only for the political institutions to mobilize them. So I'll stop here and leave the rest for the discussion. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Paul, for raising those extremely interesting legal points and also for touching on some issues connected to the future of Next Generation EU. Now, I'm conscious Calypso has to leave, so I'd like to actually open up now a first space for debate and discussion, including welcoming questions from the audience. We'll then listen to the pre-recorded presentation by Sergio Battelli and continue that conversation. But I know, Calypso, you had limited time, so I wanted to create some space here to involve you in a debate as well. And perhaps I'll take the freedom to break the ice connecting your presentation, Calypso, with that of Neil on the issue of taxes. Now, of course, I'm conscious the Jean Monnet Center of Excellence Rebuild is based in Ireland, and taxation is a big political issue for the country. But of course, I think Ireland has also changed its stance in the last year, for example, by accepting the OECD deal on global taxation. But I'd be interested in hearing what Neil and Richmond think of the question about the funding of Next Generation EU, because whether you like it or not, it's clear that by issuing common debt to an amount equal to 800 billion euros, the member states de facto agreed that that debt will have to be paid by new taxes at some point. Now, it's very much down the line, but I suspect everyone, including net payers like Ireland, would rather see new taxes sort of established at European level rather than increase their net contribution into the European budget. Isn't that the case, Neil?
I wouldn't jump so rapidly to that conclusion, Federico. In fact, I would say that's not necessarily the case, to be honest. And without sounding flippant, it's not that this is a matter of this is tomorrow's problem. I think there is going to be a way. One, first and foremost, absolutely support the commonization of debt and the measures taken in order to bring that, those funds about. I think they were the correct reaction to what were unprecedented times. And I think all of us across Europe looking at the various packages can be very grateful that those decisions were made and that those who held out, and Ireland wasn't one of those that held out, came along in due course. In terms of how you pay for that and taxes, firstly, being a net contributor to the EU is a good thing. I fundamentally believe it is a badge of pride to a country like Ireland that we've moved from being a net recipient to a net contributor. It is a reflection on a real period of economic development, which was kind of the whole point of getting involved in the EEC in the first place, to move from arguably being a second or third world country to being a first world country, being from the developing world to the developed world. And I think as I sit here in my office in Dublin, I'd like to think we can all reflect that despite a lot of domestic political back and forth, we're very lucky with the country we are living in, and it is a vastly different place socially and economically than the one that joined just over 50 years ago the European family, that we all now call the EU. But in terms of having direct taxes and the ability to raise funds directly at an EU level, that is not necessarily something Ireland has made a decision on. There is always the way that you just do what we have always done in terms of transferring capital over as a net contributor to the EU to pay for the spending and pay for the efforts that have been made and to commonalise the debt. That is a debate that I think I look forward to playing an active part in, but it is one that will happen in member state capitals before it's going to be resolved at council level. And I think I don't think you can just take it for granted that people are happy with EU taxes. That isn't necessarily the only way forward. And I can already see the sloganeering by Eurosceptics and populists about if that was to come about. You know, I think we've had the conversation before. When we had a referendum on the Fiscal Stability Treaty a couple of years ago, I was involved in the campaign. We did some research into the two biggest issues that were coming up about the Fiscal Stability Treaty, and they were about an EU army and abortion. Now, I've been around politics a long time. I don't know how they had anything to do with the Fiscal Stability Treaty. So I would urge a word of caution about the automatic assumption that we're going to have EU taxes, and urge an even greater thesis of caution about using that terminology and being very wary of how it will be spun and how it will be received. As I go back to my central point, it's I as the politician who has to get people to buy into this project. It's I as the politician whose livelihood is on the line. Sure, don't really mind about that, but we have to bring people along about it. And that's why I think there's a couple of ways to skin a cat on this one without being too colloquial. And I think it's a bit premature to assume which direction we'll go in. Come on.
Thanks, Neil. But I'd like to call on Calypso and Paul also to step in, because on the one hand, the European Council did agree back in summer 2020 that new taxes will be introduced. And also, as you said, Calypso, to some extent, taxation is a way to legitimize the Next Generation EU fund. Calypso, you're on mute, though.
Indeed, is there anything that is more important to state building than taxation, aside from going to war? But we pretend to go to war in Ukraine, but the Ukrainians do it for us. So the other thing we do to build Europe as a polity is you know, spend and tax. And I totally hear Neil here. Neil, you know, of course, you you are dealing in political imaginaries and political ideologies, and so everything that is said is full, is pregnant with meaning for citizens. But with your hat as, you know, analyst, and our hats as analysts, you know, we know that if you're there spending at some point in the future, and it really is important to ask when, there'll be three kinds of taxes to pay this spending. One, the most important one, is inflation. Inflation is a mode of redistribution from some to others. It's starting now, but we will see more of it. And that's very important. There is, of course, taxing corporations. I was speaking about the GAFAs. You know, a lot of talk, and I think it's right to say that the big corporations in Europe, whether they're European origin or American or elsewhere, benefit from the singleness of the single market, and therefore it's important that they pay into the EU. It's a quid pro quo. Fair enough, but on the other hand, taxes that they pay to the EU coffers eventually will not be taxes that they pay to the national coffers. So these are fungible. We need to recognize this. Doesn't mean it's a bad thing, right? And then, of course, the third type of tax is customs. That's what it's always been for the EU. And there we will see the emissions trading system be used also to replenish the coffers of the EU. But all of these taxes at the end of the day are fungible. And when and they are at the end of the day about where we spend our collective monies, wealth. And so the question that I was asking, and I think we really need to ask, is whether this will be accompanied by the same kind of debates that we have at the national level when there are elections. We just had them in France, and you know, there were strong contrasts between Marine Le Pen and Macron and Mélenchon, and where would they spend the money? What taxes? And the problem is that we're not ready, and we don't yet have this EU debate. So if we want to get into this new world of permanent increased taxation from the EU, and I completely agree with Paul, you know, and with Neil, I mean, you know, Paul, you were saying this, that we need a higher level of budget of fiscality in Europe, even as macroeconomic buffer, as a stabilization mechanism, let alone to spend on European infrastructure. So it is necessary, especially if it's democratic. So I am all for the increase of European capacity, but we need to think about its legitimation, given that that's what taxation is all about. Legitimate statehood.
Thanks, Calypso. Paul, do you want to jump in as well into this conversation? And then I have another quick question for Calypso before she leaves.
Yeah, very, very briefly. I mean, the discussion about the taxes that should reimburse the monies borrowed. I mean, there's a political political commitment, the Council conclusions of July 2020, and the discussion is primarily a political one. From the legal perspective, there's only one thing to say: there's this legal impediment that this has all to be agreed by unanimity, and that's potentially why the discussion is so complicated. It's really interesting to see in the conclusions of the conference how the switch from unanimity to qualified majority voting is made really central. So it's not only a technical issue; it's a truly political one which appeals to citizens. There's maybe one last option. It would certainly be the second best. I mean, option, but it's already been discussed about, is that EU might start doing what states constantly do, which is simply rolling over its debts. So in case of failure on the political side, bringing about new taxes, a possibility might be to simply roll over that debt. Of course, you would need unanimity because you would need to change the own resource decision to change the deadline for the reimbursement. It wouldn't solve anything, but it would buy you time. But once again, that would be very much the kind of incremental way of doing things, which I try to gently criticize in my intervention.
Although, Paul, can I just push back a bit here? Because I'm sitting in Florence, the land of the Medicis and the various versus King of England and all of that. We know from our history that state formation happened with indeed rolling over debt or even annulling debt. But that's a coercive mechanism, right? And kings and queens were able to do that in various ways. But default is not available. You can roll over forever, like perhaps Greece might do. But can we imagine the EU having recourse to this semi-coercive mechanism when it is much shakier ground than, you know, a nation state? I mean, I'm asking you, Paul, because
the story of the Medici isn't a great precedent of how to run a country through debt.
No, it certainly would be a disastrous message. The only point I was trying to make is that this possibility is there and it's legally feasible. But of course, politically and economically, it would be a disastrous message that I'm certainly not trying to advocate for here.
Now, I heard you. Just wanted to clarify.
Thanks a lot.
If I can instead take advantage of you being still with us, Calypso, for a few more minutes, I'd like to ask you a question about the relationship between representation and participation. And perhaps Neil, as an elected representative, might come back to this later as well. But in your presentation, you emphasize the issues of accountability and you said we need representation, no representation without taxation, and then also participation. But aren't these two elements actually in contradiction with each other? Doesn't an increase in participation through citizens' assemblies or the likes of the Conference on the Future of Europe, in fact, weaken representation or representative institutions?
Well, Federico, that's the $500 question. And I'm sure Neil would have things to say about this. I mean, for those of us who followed Kofi very closely, we could see that indeed, everybody would say no, answer no to your question in public in a Zoom like this, which is recorded. All the representatives, MP, MEPs, politicians will say, no, we love citizens' participation, wonderful input, we love them, they have such wonderful things to say. And indeed, by the way, parenthetically, there was very interesting proposals on taxation, targeted taxation from the citizens in the 49 proposal at the end. Really interesting debates on indeed what taxation is for. According to me, these people who would say, you know, oh, no problem, Federico, are, you know, would be right to say it. But the point is they don't always think it. That is, in the traditional representative world, and I don't include Neil there, but, you know, there are many who think that participation is indeed fine and good if it's a footnote, but it shouldn't be too intrusive on representative democracy, which is the core, the be-all and end-all of democracy. And yes, that is true historically, but we live in the 21st century, where when we speak about participation, yes, we're talking about mini-public, citizens' assembly, but we're also speaking about, you know, how the media does it. You know, I alluded to groups of journalists, but also civil society organizations, etc., that are the watchdog of monetary democracy. That are the ones who would go if we had a democratic panopticon, if we had every single cent euro of spending of Next Generation EU on the web, because indeed we are in a world of executive dominance that Paul described, European level and national level. But if to compensate that, all the spending, you know, we would know, okay, there are, you know, 100,000 solar panels funded for the south of Italy. Well, which is the firm that installs it? How is it going? That would be amazing because it's the citizens on the ground, it's these groups who know, it's the trade unions. But if they don't have the information, and right now we still have very aggregate information about how the money is spent, then they can't do their job as civil society. So I think, yes, there is some tension, Federico, between those two logic, those two cultures of representation. In my view, they need to go together. But I think it will take a long time still to reconcile everybody on how they need to go together. That's the thinking that needs to be done for the next years to come. So I'm sure we'll have the conversation again. And it's been wonderful to be part of this conversation, Federico, for at this moment in time.
And thank you very much, Calypso, for joining us. I should acknowledge you have had a longstanding role on the debate on the future of Europe, dating back to the time of the convention some 20 years ago. So we were delighted to welcome you back, Calypso. And I think the point we were just discussing is a point we should return to in a second, the one of representation. But before doing so, let me actually virtually call in another elected representative, Mr. Sergio Battelli, chairman of the EU Affairs Committee of the Italian Parliament, who, as I said, could not join us due to a last-minute institutional commitment, but he just sent us this video, which we are now projecting. It's 6 minutes, and then we'll restart our discussion.
Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for inviting me to present my contribution at this important event. Thank you, Professor Fabbrini, and to the Center to promote this gather together to reflect on the economic governance in the EU after the conference of the Future of the Europe event. Let me start with a very straightforward but extremely important consideration. The proposal path forward in the conclusion of the conference of the Future of Europe go very much in the same direction and in many cases overlap with the main goals defined by the European Commission, both in general and in NGO in particular. I am thinking about health, labor market, but also fiscal and tax policy, the driver of economic growth, the green and digital transition see as the core of the whole innovation, the focus of the strong social dimension in the European semester and empowering citizens. As obvious as this call seems taking into account that the institutions are the engine of the conference, the fact that many proposals coincide with the pillar on which the EU Commission, together with the other institutions, are building their policies, tell us, and more importantly, tell them that they are focusing on the right topics. They are focusing on the topics important for the EU citizens. Moreover, and more importantly, under my point of view, tell policymakers, including me, that the goal and the main point on which we build RRF plans are right. At the same time, the extent of the conclusion emphasized that a lot needs to be done, that the world as we know, the economy as we know, the welfare as we know, the external relation as we know, and so on and so forth, strongly need to be retooled, reconsidered and reinvented. At the same time, this is also sending us a clear message. It is impossible to reach all the mentioned goal in the NGU time frame, so the program must become structural. That said, I would like to focus your attention to a few specific recommendations that I believe are particularly important and relevant. This is not to say that there others are not, but I believe that, among others, have a specific relevance. The proposal of fiscal and tax policies clearly says that harmonizing and coordinating tax policies within the member state of the EU in the order to prevent tax evasion and the evidence avoiding taxes having within the EU and targeting offshoring within Europe, including by answering that decision on the tax matter can be taken by qualified majority in the Council and the EU. This is an aspect that I strongly support and that I have been working on my electoral mandate both at national and the EU level. I am well aware that there wasn't unanimity, but the fact that is in the conclusion mirrors its importance and tell us that it is finally the right time to act. It also states that the EU promote future-oriented investment focused on the green and digital transition with a strong social and gender dimension. Citizens want to move away taxation from people and SMEs and the target tax evaders, big polluters, and by taxing the digital giants. Here we set the foundation of the important redistributive policy within the EU that in my view is absolutely key in order to counterbalance the shock of the internal markets in an environment where taxes are collected at the national level, but the imbalance happened at the EU level. This momentum, their awareness of the EU citizens on the importance of tax policies, but followed some by policies mirroring the request. Moreover, there is a proposal on the reduction of dependency of the EU from foreign actors in energy. This proposal is in line with the need to address in fast and need that the EU reach more autonomy in the field of energy production and supply. In this field, the EU part forward a REPowerEU that is central of the proposal to modify the RRF regulation in order to include a new chapter in the RRF plan specifically to focus on energy. It is indeed an important challenge that must be addressed in the shortest time, and once again we see the EU ready to act. But all policies must go in the same direction, and at national level we need to support the effort and fast implement it. Furthermore, the proposal on transparency of the EU and its relation with the citizens focuses on the key point. Transparency is a pillar to strongly involve the citizens. Transparency is the one of the tools we should develop if we want to transform democracy in order to make it fit better our current times. Transparency is the prerequisite to involvement, to discuss and to make citizens part of the decision-making process. To conclude, let me focus briefly on the implementation of the necessary measures. Some measures could be implemented through already existing policies and can be achieved by making full use of the existing institutional framework at the European and the national level. Firstly, we need to fully explore the possibility of the existing framework. However, we should not rule out the possibility to put forward a revision of the treaties. The revision should be focused on a specific elements with the goal of making the EU stronger, able to act fast and efficiently. It is the time for us, policymakers, scholars, professionals, citizens in general, to start reshaping the EU to better fit times and especially our needs. A path is traced. Let's very soon start to act. Let me then conclude with this exhortation. Now is the time to implement the proposal that the conference put forward. Now is the time to act and to act fast in order to change the idea that the EU cannot be effective in addressing challenges. Thank you very much.
So we have heard from Sergio Battelli, the chairman of the EU Affairs Committee of the Italian Parliament. I was actually very keen on making sure we would have an Italian representative to address our event this afternoon, not least because, as most of you will certainly know, Italy alone receives basically a third of the next generation EU budget. So what Italy is doing with it and the stance of the country with regard to that budget, I think, is of particular relevance. And I welcome that Sergio, despite being not an English speaker, mother tongue, and despite being unable to join us live this afternoon, still sent us this message. We've heard him. He said the Conference on the Future of Europe had clear recommendation to make next generation EU a permanent tool. Italy wants that to be a permanent tool, and we need also to reform the treaty. So I want to ask maybe Paul, because he addressed that in his remark, is that a typical Southern request on the future of Europe, and how is that going to play out considering a different position from Northern member states?
Well, it's certainly a reform avenue which is more widely supported in the south than it is in the north. So, I mean, bringing about treaty change on these points would be extremely difficult. It will need to be part of a of an overarching deal, but I don't think it's unfeasible either. To a certain extent, the path has been traced, as Sergio said, with Next Generation EU. So we have a precedent, and now we need to make sure that this precedent is successful. So it's about the practical success of the plan and how the money will be efficiently spent. So, I mean, we'll need to see how things evolve. That's basically all I can say at this very stage. But you can expect the opposition from certain member states to be strong.
I will come back to the point about the future of Next Generation EU. But maybe Neil, if I can call you in on something, because of course the Irish Taoiseach gave a very important speech in Strasbourg exactly a week ago on the 8th of June. And perhaps that has not been covered across European media as it should have had, in my view. And I think one of the interesting statements that the Micheál Martin made on that occasion was also that Ireland is open to the prospect of treaty changes. And I'd like to ask your view on that as someone who's also very much an insider to Irish politics. Of course, in the rest of Europe, Ireland is often being seen with some worry whenever a treaty change discussion is being made because of the no votes to Nice and Lisbon. But hasn't the climate changed enormously in Ireland also as a result of Brexit? Maybe you can say more.
Yeah, no, like every intervention at a European level, it doesn't get the amount of coverage it should do in the media, to be honest. And I think that is one of the sorry things that we must learn from the Brexit process, that you can't spend 40 years giving out about something and then expect people in 6 weeks to turn around and vote for it. So I think there is a responsibility on all of us to talk about things that happen at a European level a lot more regularly and in the level of depth that the rare occasions like these Zooms afford. In terms of the Taoiseach's comments, I think that it's really interesting. And I find this interesting. And yes, as a participant in the conference, and yes, as an elected rep who is a backbench member of this government, because it is a bit of a shift. And I know when we had our initial discussions prior to the conference plenary being formed, there was a clear reluctance towards treaty change from the Irish government. And there is lots of reasons for this. One, if you're going to have treaty change, you have to have a good reason for it. What's the justification before it? And we see the outcomes of the conference would lean their way. You know, the responses were quite clear, as Paul mentioned. And without being too cynical, yes, there is a fear of treaty change in Ireland for the very reason that we are constitutionally obliged to put this to a referendum. Personally, I'm not a massive fan of referenda. I think, as I allocated with my, or as I talked about when with my anecdote about the fiscal stability treaty, you often get up talking about things that aren't in, that aren't actually, you're not actually voting for. And that was very, very apparent in Brexit. When I remember one lady on Sky News saying she voted leave because her bins hadn't been collected the previous Thursday. We have to be very careful when we rush to direct democracy in form of referenda. And I might just pivot, if you don't mind, Federico, back into some of the points in relation to accountability and the role of the citizens' assemblies format and the conference and this level of citizen engagement that Paul referred to quite succinctly. And this, I suppose, would have formed an element of the Taoiseach's remarks, that the recommendations from this conference, one would assume, lend themselves in the convention to quite clear requirement for treaty change, and therefore there's a responsibility at this stage on all member states to keep everything on the table. Can't just say we'll take all the recommendations that, or maybe some of the recommendations that don't require treaty change, or we'll work in or improve existing programs. But where there is a clear recommendation, it has to be considered. So it's premature for anyone to say we're not going to make Next Generation EU permanent, or it's premature for someone to say, well, we don't require a treaty change for this. So I think we're at the stage where it is all on the table. But to the wider point about the role of the citizens and this sort of structure, I despite previous comments, I like this structure. I thought the citizens' assemblies worked really well in Ireland. And I think the conference actually brought a really good challenge to elected representatives, both on a European level and those of us from a member state level. And the thing about those citizens' assemblies and the conference, though, is you can't use them all the time. And I'd be quite critical of my own government on domestic, and not to spend too domestic, that it's now become a little bit too easy to kick things to a citizens' assembly. I fundamentally believe in Ireland dealing with marriage equality, dealing with abortion, should we get to that stage, dealing with neutrality, dealing with possible Irish unification, all merit a citizens' assembly. And there's a very, very important role to take it out of the day-to-day back and forth of politics. The issues are too serious, and also and allow the space to form that when a decision needs to be made by the citizens, that it's a very clear choice. Again, learn the lessons of Brexit. Do not present people a binary option without actually knowing what leave or remain means, what yes or no means. When we went to vote in 2018 on repeal the 8th, it was pretty clear that if we voted to repeal, what the legislative journey was going to take place. And that came not just from the Citizens' Assembly, but the subsequent parliamentary committee that made the recommendations. And the government made that quite clear. So The responsibility, though, now is to manage of the elected representatives, be they at a council level or, no, it will be at the council level, is to manage the expectations of those citizens who went into the Conference of Future Europe. And one of the things, and I would be quite critical of the structure of the conference, and there's lots of reasons why the structure wasn't nailed down. There was political game playing quite clearly between the big political groups, between the institutions. But it meant that different working groups took different models. The fact that we had working groups in the first place all came into play. And it meant it took a long time and then decisions were quite rushed. So we just accepted everything. So we didn't vote on anything. And not enough work was done. I don't know if it was widespread. They call it the traffic light system, about what recommendations were possible, potentially possible, not possible. And often when they were not possible, it was either down to the competencies of the EU. What's a member state competency? What's an institutional competency? But crucially, what's already being done? You know, we want X to be done. Well, that's fine, actually. There's been an EU program on that for the last 7 years. It's the EU's fault that they haven't told people about it, or there isn't, you know, we're talking of things that are removed, and yet how do we bring it down to the citizenry? And this is the perennial difficulty. And I hate using the word, and I've waited 50 or 63 minutes to use it, but how do we really believe in subsidiarity and how do we bring it down? Subsidiarity is crucial to the European project, but it is a word that when you say it in any form of discussion, the blinkers come down and the brains leave the room, because you know you're getting into the menial detail and the horse trading between institutions and member states. So to be very, very succinct, because I know we're coming to a close, the Conference of the Future Europe, much like the Citizens' Assembly, they are really, really complementary, but the recommendations are only as good as the response that the council or a government of the day provide. So if the council says, yeah, we're going to accept all your recommendations, but we're going to sit on them and not do anything about them, it's a false purpose. We shouldn't have doing it. But if the council can turn around and go, you know what, you've made your 50 odd recommendations. If we want to do 25 of them, that's going to require a treaty change. We can do 7 without a treaty change, but 2 of those we just don't want to do. Let's be honest about what can be done. And if it requires a treaty change, I have no fear of a European treaty. To your point, has the Irish mindset changed? It has for now, but that doesn't mean it'll be in the same place in a couple of months' time. You know, there could be lots of reasons. And one of the real interesting, and not to be too partially political, and I'll finish on this point, the really interesting thing for me is if we have another referendum on a European treaty, will Sinn Féin, for the first time in their history, actually back a referendum about Europe? Will this be part of the mainstreaming process in the Republic?
Thanks, Neil, for your thoughts on that. And thanks also for your, in my view, very convincing criticism of the abuse of participatory democracy and the importance of guaranteeing that some issues are dealt with by elected representatives. Of course, one would suspect it coming from an elected representative, but I think it's actually a fair one, as there are limits to what I think citizens can discuss. And in many ways, the conference highlighted also the challenges of having people who are not specialists discuss very technical subjects. Now, we have still about 10 minutes to take questions from the floor. So please do not hesitate to raise your virtual hand if you want to step in. In the meanwhile, I might abuse again my role as chair and ask a question to both Neil and Paul, and perhaps it's a provocative question, but it has to do with sort of the foundations of Next Generation EU. Because on the one hand, as Paul said, we probably have to change the treaties to guarantee a permanent fiscal capacity. And certainly one of the clear recommendations from the Conference on the Future of Europe is that the citizens want Europe to have financial capacity to deal with the challenges it's facing. And yet Next Generation EU has been established without having to change the treaties. It has been established by simply using the legal basis and the treaties as we have them now. So is that a paradox? How is it possible that we did it but without having to change the treaty, but now we're calling for treaty change? Maybe, Paul, you should go first on that.
Well, I think the main reason is that, I mean, NGU has always been, at least that's the way that the official version goes, has always been presented as a one-off instrument, very much dictated by the exceptionality of the COVID-19 crisis. If you now want to be open about having a permanent capacity, that narrative no longer functions. So there's a bit of a paradox in this
political sense. Narrative rather than a legal one.
Excuse me?
Could it be a political narrative that it's one off rather than a legal one? I mean, if you do can do it one legally, why can't you do it twice legally?
No, you could certainly replicate the template as another one-off instrument for the next crisis coming up. But you'll always need to go through that kind of process before launching it. What we're talking about with the permanent fiscal capacities is different. This would mean the immediate executive capacity to react without having to go through the kind of negotiations that we witnessed in 2020. So I think there lies the main difference. But there's a bit of a paradox, because indeed, when you look at the way NGU functions and the kind of commitments it involves, it's more than a one-off. When you see its goals, I mean, its goals are to basically consolidate the fundamental basics of European economies. So this goes far beyond mere recovery. So
there is a tension there. But in your view, Paul, I mean, is the conference on the future of Europe and the final report ultimately strengthening the case to make NGU into a permanent tool? Or how do you interpret it?
I mean, at the very least, it shows that there's popular support for this idea, and that's certainly not nothing. It shows also that it's not a purely meridional request. It's actually widely shared across the continent. Then, of course, the way it translates into politics is different. But from a citizen perspective, the Finn, the Swedes, the Irish supports it almost as much as the Spanish or the Italian. That's already a strong and significant message that the conference is sending.
That's a good point, Paul. And maybe I come back to you, Neil. Of course, we've been focusing here today mostly on Next Generation EU, but to be fair, the European Union has put together a number of analogous financing mechanism in the last few years. There was the SURE instrument to support unemployment, and very important for Ireland, the Brexit Adjustment Reserve, which is an ad hoc instrument approved also in the European Council conclusion of July 2020, which transfers funds to the member states most affected by the UK withdrawal. And actually, Ireland is the prime net beneficiary of the Brexit Adjustment Reserve. In fact, I think Ireland is getting more money out of the Brexit Adjustment Reserve, over €1 billion, than it is under Next Generation EU, which is just below €1 billion. So I might pick up your brain and ask you, perhaps as a final question from my side, what's the perception, in your opinion, in Ireland about Next Generation EU? What do you get when talking to your constituents? And what overall is the sense about the added value of this project? And do you think it would be feasible politically to sell it as a permanent feature of the European Union?
I hate to burst your bubble, Federico, but no constituent of mine has ever raised Next Generation EU. I think it's being frank. They've never raised it directly. And this is the key point. So when I go on the doorsteps, or we have a big meeting in my constituency with the Taoiseach this evening, and what will the members be raising? They'll be raising cost of living. They'll be raising housing. They'll be raising how their businesses can be supported coming out of COVID. And when we deal with Next Generation EU, it's the exact same. When I go to a primary school and talk to people, to kids about politics, and I go, how many of you like politics? Put up your hand. Obviously, none of them put up their hands. But I ask them how many of them like parks or playgrounds or libraries or football pitches or bike lanes or cycling. I don't use the term infrastructure, but you know what I mean. Loads of hands start coming up. And it's the exact same with both Next Generation EU and the Brexit Adjustment Reserve Fund. And it is a damning indictment of politicians like me that we treat our electorate like I treat seven and eight-year-olds in primary school. Because we need to be quite clear that when we're talking about recovery and rebuilding, and we're talking about all the supports that were put in, that we say, well, look, a lot of this comes back to Next Generation EU. And we talk about Irish fishermen who've received large payments from the Brexit Adjustment Fund, or you talk about diversification and Glanbia starting to export buffalo mozzarella as opposed to cheddar cheese, that we have to talk about, well, this is where the funds are coming from, and you need to have a say in that. And we need to treat them with the level of respect that we will actually talk about this. And it's a horrible affliction of politicians across the European Union. When there's money going out, it's an achievement of the local government. When there is an unpopular decision to be made in terms of legislation or regulation or transposing a directive, it's all Brussels' fault. So no constituents of mine directly raise Next Generation EU. They don't directly raise the Brexit Adjustment Fund. They don't. They definitely don't raise changes to the treaties, but they do at the same time. So it's a contradiction. And that's why, to pick up on one of the points that Paul made in relation, and you made in relation to legal versus political, never ever waste the opportunities of a crisis. So we've had the crisis of Brexit, we've had the crisis of the pandemic, we're now having the crisis of the war in Ukraine, and I'm not in any way belittling them, but they have allowed the EU to move in a manner that's been so flexible and swift that when I was doing my master's thesis, I was learning that it was impossible. The EU doesn't do this. And I don't know if you're still teaching postgrad students that or where we're going, but we have to be fair that what the EU has done over the last decade and before that, since the financial crisis, has been unprecedented. And they've broken a lot of their supposed rules and laws. And that's a good thing. It's shown the flexibility that a large organization of so many competing parts, like when it comes to Brexit, who would have thought that 27 EU member states could maintain absolute solidarity in a unified position whilst the United Kingdom just simply couldn't nail down a position? So to get back and to finish on this point about the opportunities presented and whether this is a one-off, precedent will now always be there. And we have to look at what the next crisis is. And I fundamentally believe that the war in Ukraine should focus all minds across the European Union. I made this point in Strasbourg. It is showing the European Union of the importance of being able to get back to basics. Why do we have a European Union today? Where are the opening salvos in terms of the European Economic Community, in terms of the common of the coal and steel, the common coal and steel project, in terms of Euratom, in terms of the foundation of CAP? How do we feed people? How do we protect people? How do we supply our own energy? And there is a great opportunity for the EU, whilst doing lots of things and putting resources into it, to go back to those key areas, to look at how we feed ourselves and indeed our responsibility to the developing world in terms of feeding them. How do we create and protect our own energy? And in turn, going back to the final point, that every recommendation in the Conference of the Future Europe had a very, very distinct desire from the citizens of addressing the climate emergency. The challenge for elected representatives and those who engage in the process is, how do you do that in a way that you can get people on side? And that is the riddle that I've been spending my entire professional career trying to answer.
Thanks, Neil, for that. And let me actually acknowledge in the audience, we have also representatives from the EU institutions, both the Commission representation in Ireland, but also Danuta Hübner, the former chairwoman of the European Parliament Constitutional Affairs Committee. It has been a fascinating discussion. I'm grateful to all of our speakers for joining us this afternoon. We have touched on highly important issues, Next Generation EU and the Conference on the Future of Europe. And of course, I want to emphasize that our new project, the Jean Monnet Center of Excellence Rebuild, is going to follow closely those issues for the next few years.
You've been listening to Amplify, which is made with the support of the European Union's Erasmus Plus program and the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe initiative, although these institutions do not necessarily endorse its contents. It is produced by the DCU Brexit Institute in association with the Jean Monnet Centre of Excellence Rebuild. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romano.